there's quite a few questions. So anyway, you may not be able to understand me because I've got a slight speech impediment at the moment. So please let me know if you can't understand, and I'll try to clarify it. And I'm sure that some of the others would like to have a go at answering some of the questions too. Now, dear Ajahn, last night there was a question about abortion. It was late and Ajahn Brahm did not have the time to say much. He touched briefly on the point at which the fetus becomes a separate entity to its mother. But in his talks, I've heard him give a lot more detail, especially the need for caution. In today's quick fix world, we often take the quick fix solution without realizing the long-term consequences. Could you comment? It's interesting that usually there is a question about abortion at every kind of question and answer session, whether we hold it at Dhammaloka or it's part of a retreat. So it's obviously a question of some concern for people, and especially it's a cause for a lot of anguish in a lot of women who've had abortions and who are seeking some sort of peace around the issue. And they often have been carrying distress about having had an abortion for many years. And so the first thing to say is that while Buddhism doesn't condone abortion, we always are on the side of compassion. And this is something that comes across very clearly in Ajahn Brahm's talks generally, but also specifically on this issue. Ajahn Brahm has also brought up the aspect of when the consciousness actually arises in the fetus, so that it then has the potential to become a fully formed living being with a consciousness such as we know. If that consciousness does not arise, then even though the physical manifestation of the fetus can be present, that baby will be stillborn. And so this is what Ajahn Brahm has suggested sometimes, that because we don't know the time, the exact moment when the consciousness arises in the fetus, that there is some room for questioning, because we don't know when that child is actually a separate being from its mother. But because we don't know, this is just the very reason why we have to be particularly careful. We don't know, and therefore we can't be sure that we're doing something that we think is not killing, when in fact it is killing a living being. And that's the point around which Ajahn Brahm may have been was alluding to, and which is the point that is open for debate in terms of whether that child is a conscious being or not, that fetus is a conscious being or not, at what point that happens. Is there anyone would like to ask?
What would be the
In that case, when it's a living being, it's killing a living being. But the karmic consequences of any action are never straightforward, in the sense that there are always other factors that are taken into account when the karmic consequences flow from the mind state of the person that was committing the action. And also there may be many other factors. For example, someone may, with great regret, have an abortion because they cannot materially. They have many children, they cannot survive another child coming into their household. That's not a justification for having an abortion. But someone with great regret may commit that action. Someone else may commit that action very lightly. They may think that it's something that they will interfere with their life or their lifestyle, and so they take the action very lightly. The mental state of the person that's carrying out the action will have some effect. And there are many other factors that karmically affect any action that we do. So you can't give a blanket statement about anything, although that you can recognise that the karmic consequence of having an abortion is of taking life. I'm pleased to have the opportunity to listen to our nuns. You may not be so pleased to listen to this nun tonight. This retreat, I have come ahead in leaps and bounds in mindfulness. I find it easy to find peace walking in the bush, but when sitting, I can't still my mind as readily. I persevere as I believe sitting in meditation to be the groundwork. So, following Achyam Brahm's instructions, just be at peace with the fact, however it is when you sit down, and don't force that that it should be the same as when you're in the bush. It's as it is when you sit down. So allow it to be, and be peaceful and kind towards it. And contentment is really important, just to be content with it as it is. And I'm glad that you have come along in leaps and bounds. Dear Vayama, it is a blessing and joy to have you and Venerable Seri and Samaneri with us on retreat. Please, I could you tell us what conditions made you decide to take take the sacred robe. Maybe Venerable Seri and Samaneri might like to share their experience as well. With deep respect to the Bhikkhuni Sangha and the blessings from the Triple Gem. So, often we are asked what made us become nuns, and so I'd like to give someone else the opportunity. I just feel that you've heard my story so often, but one thing I think that's that I have certainly found over the years is that the reasons why I became a nun change somewhat during the as you develop more wisdom and understanding about motivation and your own mind, you see that what you thought was the case was sometimes different. And certainly as you stay a nun, you see that there are many more positives to staying in robes that you perhaps weren't aware of when you first ordained. So I recently had my 25th ordination anniversary as a 10 precept nun, but of course since then we have become bhikkhunis last October. So it's important, I think, just to state that the reason why it is so important that we became bhikkhunis was because only as a bhikkhuni is one a full member of the Sangha. And as a samaneri or a 10 precept nun, as we were, we are not officially full members of the Sangha. So it was really important for us to take the step so that we could be recognized and participate fully in the Sangha. So, would you like to say something?
Same thing. I think I answered the same questions last in November. I must say, I personally also felt like it had been so far a very amazing journey, and I was full of gratitude to have the opportunity to become a nun. I remember that about 8 years ago, 2002, when I went to my boss to ask for 6 months on pay leave so that I can went to Dhammasara. Initially, the requirement is to spend 6 months as Anagarika, and then the monastery will see whether I'm a suitable candidate and whether I will like it. So I don't dare to tell anyone that I'm planning to become a nun, so I just say, can I take 6 months on pay leave? So I did, and I haven't returned since then. And I did tell my boss that I'm not going back. But from then, I took Anagarika ordination, and then to become a seminary or 10 precept nuns in 2004. And last year, I have the great opportunity and for myself, I felt very inspiring and full of gratitude to have the opportunity to take a bhikkhuni ordination. So I must say, I started off not from anything. It's a leap of faith that I can say that that's how I started off when I began. I didn't plan to. As I say, I just asked for 6 months on pay leave, and all my family friends think that I will not make it because it's too cold at Dhammasara and it's too tough, and all sorts of reasons they think that I will come back in a few months. So, but I'm very happy to have the opportunity. And when I heard someone say that trust the Dhamma, which I felt that have been leading me to an amazing journey, and I met my teacher Ajahn Vam and Ajahn Brahm, very full of gratitude to them that I can be sitting here today, and about 8 years down the road, and I am a member of BSWA before I enter Dhamma, become a nun or become Anagarika Dhammasara. So I'm very fortunate to have the monastery at my doorstep. I'm from Perth as well, and work in Perth, study in Perth. So I'm very fortunate in that sense. And have Ajahn Varma started the monastery, Dhammasara, so that I have the opportunity to be trained in Perth and to be here. So thanks all. Thank you.
First, let me just introduce myself. I'm seminary Nisara. I actually came to Perth in November of 2008 and stayed for 2.5 months. So many of you I actually do recognize and remember fondly from my visit that time, but maybe you don't remember me because I looked a little bit different. You know how in the movies when people go in disguise, they wear wigs? Well, it works the other way too. If you baldify yourself, you also look a little different. So hello again. It's kind of funny that I'm already a nun, but in another way, it's also not surprising. I feel like for me, it's something that probably has been building long before I realized it was building. Ever since I was a child, I grew up in the Philippines, actually, although by passport I am Thai and my parents are Thai. I was born and raised mostly in the Philippines, and when I was a little girl, I lived very close to a Catholic convent, and our house was so small that my father would park his car in the convent. We would go there and visit and play with the nuns. They were Catholic sisters, but for me, they were a very good sort of first inspiring example of women who are ordained and women who are living joyfully ordained. And it didn't strike me as strange or weird. They were just sisters who were nice to be around because they were very kind and happy. And so I think maybe deep down that stayed in my mind. But I think I understand now, even in just 9.5, 10 months of being a novice. I've been getting this question a lot, so I really understand now when Ajahn Mariama says that she's had many opportunities to answer this question. So I think I should get some practice. I think every time I answer it, a different version comes out because there is just such a nexus of different reasons, conscious or unconscious, that probably lead to this step. But to summarize, I think I always had this sort of spiritual interest and a sense that would be the most important thing to pursue in life. I remember at my college admissions interview, I did my university studies in the U.S., and the question came up sort of like, what is your goal in life? And without even thinking or without even planning what would be an impressive answer or what would be a really professional sounding answer, I just said, spiritual growth. And I think looking back, it's like, well, little high school me knew myself better than I thought I did. And so I think it's funny that sometimes deep down you probably have a sense of what it is that you're, you know, what your calling is, that kind of thing. It sounds, I never used to really understand when people talked about that. Like, I used to ask people, well, why did you ordain? I understand, it's a fascinating question. And they would say, you know, I just felt a calling. I'm like, what calling? I don't understand. I have no sense what my calling is, but I think over time it just kind of developed, and I think that I think everyone has a different approach. I think my approach is different from Venerable Sari's. I don't think I was as brave as she was to take this huge leap of faith so quickly. For me, I'm sort of the type who, like learning to swim, I sort of edge from the like baby pool into the shallow end of the big pool and kind of, you know, clutch the side of the pool before I head towards the deep end. So for me, it was just years of starting to learn about Buddhism and to meditate and to go to more talks and stay at the monastery a little bit. And my time here was actually really valuable. I'm very grateful to have had the chance to come and stay here in the hospitality of Dhammasara Monastery to allow me to stay, and the kindness of the lay people to make me feel so welcome, that I had such a good time with my first experience of being, you know, to sort of simulate what life in the monastery would be like. And I think that was it helped me a lot in the sense that it clarified things. When I went back to Thailand, really my feeling was like a relief, because I had sort of come up in my idea of wanting to ordain for many years, but it was sort of like, are you sure? Are you sure? Are you really sure that you want to do this kind of thing? And I was just so relieved that I actually liked it. It would have been if I had to go back and be like, actually, I didn't like that either, so what am I going to do now? So I'm very, 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 very relieved and grateful that I had that chance to have a positive experience with monastic life that gave me greater confidence to take it further. And it wasn't at all sort of planned that I would ordain in Thailand or that I would ordain so quickly, which is why when Sister Sari says, or Venerable Sari says, you know, learning to trust in the Dhamma, that was also one of those sort of stock phrases I never really, you know, understood clearly, and I probably still don't understand clearly, but I'm understanding more clearly that if you just take the you out of the decision making, and it's a lot less agonizing. You know, I'm definitely the very intellectual type, you know, pro list, con list. Do I do A? Do I do B? Do I do monastery this or that? And in many ways, I really feel fortunate to be a woman. And this is not to be like, to be sarcastic or anything, but I really do feel this. In some ways, not having a lot of choices made it so much easier. You know, with men in Thailand, it's just filled with monasteries and this great Kruba Ajahn or that great teacher. And it's like, where was the best monastery for me? But, you know, luckily, there aren't that many choices for women yet. And so I think I do a lot better when I don't have a lot of choices. So when it was sort of like, well, you know, there's this place in Chiang Mai and they have a nice, you know, community there, and I thought, okay, I'll try ordaining temporarily during the rains retreat, because in Thailand it's a cultural practice that's very common for, you know, men to ordain during the Vasa just for temporary reasons. And they had an opportunity open up to do a temporary seminary ordination. At first they said just temporary matchy ordination. I was like, okay, you know, whatever, let me just try what it feels like to be in real robes. And at the last minute they said, you know, we'll let you do temporary seminary ordination. So I said, oh, I mean, deep down I really wanted to do that, right? But, you know, so I was really happy that they had that opportunity arise. And so I said, okay. And I went and I did it, and I really enjoyed it so much, and I felt I learned a lot, and I felt like in 3 months, I felt my Dhamma practice really grew much quicker than when I was a layperson. So I thought, well, why do I have to go anywhere so quickly? Can I stay on? And so I've just been kind of taking it as it comes, and I just feel like, if you have a certain, you know, purity of intention, that the Dhamma will lead you the best way that, you know, or any way that will work well for you, or to work well for just the Dhamma to be in the world. So I think that it's a lot easier when you don't have to think, well, should I stay here or should I do that? Or is this teacher the right one for me? And can I really survive trying to understand the suttas in Thai? You know, I think as long as it's helping both yourself and other people, if you feel like there is value in being anywhere, then I'm just taking it a step at a time. But again, I feel very grateful for the chance to come and hear teachings in English and meditate in an international environment. I have to say that too is also a very, you know, precious opportunity, because it's very inspiring to see. When you live in Thailand and everyone sort of, you know, just sort of, I guess, Buddhist by default, you can forget how lucky you are to be that close to it. And then when you come here and you just see people who, they really had to already go against the flow just to investigate Buddhism further, or to, you know, not, you probably get a lot of questions, maybe, I'm guessing, that if your family wasn't Buddhist or your friends aren't Buddhist, you probably get very similar questions that I get from friends who aren't, you know, going off to be ordained, you know, just because it's a little different from what everyone else does. So I think that seeing so many of you here probably having gone through that questioning but still seeking the truth at a deeper level, I think that's really very powerful and inspiring, to see that and to see the commitment and to see the great harmony with which this community seems to operate, I think that that's really wonderful to bring back and maybe share when I go back to Thailand. So I've probably spoken a bit too long. That's just how I am. It's my conditioning. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to explain myself a little bit. Thank you.
Dear Ajahn Vayama, can one achieve jhana when they attend retreat now and again? Does one practice daily or even regularly, and during a retreat, one gets to experience good results? I think it's important to know that sometimes a jhana happens, as Ajahn Brahm says, people fluke a jhana. So we can never say that a jhana is impossible to achieve if you don't practice the whole of the Eightfold Path. But fluke is one thing. If you really want to systematically practice, you have to practice in the whole of your life. The Noble Eightfold Path includes the way you make your living, the way you look after your relationships with people, the way that you act ethically in the world. All of those things lead to harmony with other people and also harmony within yourself. And so that is a very important precursor for growing the spiritual qualities that are necessary for the attainment of the jhanas. So, for example, not to be worried about what you've done during the day helps you to be more peaceful, and it helps you to be more mindful of your mental states. Because if you've been doing something that you feel ashamed of or worried about, or that leads to a lot of friction, then you're more likely to be mindless, because it's not pleasant to be with those mental states. And so the mindlessness that you are practicing actually becomes a habit pattern that's hard to break when you come into meditation and you try to be mindful. And so you're undermining any progress that you're making in one direction by how you're living your life. So you really need to cultivate that kind of ethical, wholesome lifestyle to support yourself in the meditation practice. And then when you're practicing in this way, you're more likely to pay attention to what your actual experience is. So wisdom or insight is more likely to develop. And the little insights that you have in your daily life help you to see the benefits of your practice more clearly, the benefits of living in this way, a spiritual life, or living according to the precepts. And so that encourages you to keep practicing. So all of these things help you to develop, so that when you come to a meditation retreat, you're not starting from scratch to try to develop your mindfulness, to try to develop your peace and calm, to try to pay attention to what's actually happening in your experience. If you're not practicing wholeheartedly, then it's very difficult, because you're always going back to the beginning and starting again when you come on a retreat. It's much wiser much more beneficial if you continue the practice when you leave retreat. And of course you can't practice at the same intensity, but you don't lose what you've gained to the same extent as when you don't practice. And as the momentum builds up, even out of retreat situation, you can observe a growth in your happiness and in your peace of mind, and that encourages you to keep on practicing and to make more time to come on retreats rather than, oh, well, a retreat is option three or four on your list. It becomes option one to try and do a retreat at least once a year. So anyone can fluke a jhana, but if you want to practice systematically, you have to look at the whole of your life. Achan Bayama, who did you train under? Was your teacher much different to Achan Bayama and Char's style? So I started at Wat Buddha Dharma, which is was a monastery outside Sydney. It still is in existence today. My first monastic teacher was Aikema, who was a German-born Australian nun in her 60s when I first met her. And I went to Sri Lanka and originally was going to spend just 3 months at the retreats, as a retreat centre, at the retreat centre. But I ended up deciding to stay on to ordain under her. So my first monastic teacher was Aikema, and she taught very unusually for that time. She emphasised jhana practice. So that's really the common link, apart from the fact that Achan Bayama is a monastic too, is that his style of practice is very much emphasising the jhanas, and that was quite unusual even in those times back in the early 80s when Aikema was teaching. There was a lot of emphasis in Sri Lanka and in the Western world, Buddhist world, on Vipassana and the Burmese style of practice. And she was really quite outstanding in teaching jhana practice and using the suttas of the Buddha a lot to back up the importance of the jhanas, even though it wasn't a very popular amongst the teaching fraternity of that day. And I started my monastic life with all-night sits and starting at 4 o'clock every day and having 2-hour sits in the morning and 2-hour sits in the afternoon. So a sort of similar, fairly strict regime as Achan Bayama would have experienced in the early days. Dear Achan Bayama, how would a person like Devadatta, with a will to kill the Buddha, can attain jhana? Isn't jhana achievable if you have sila, dana and bhavana? Devadatta was the cousin of the Buddha, for those of you who don't know. And through the jhanas, he developed psychic powers. And he used those psychic powers to influence others. and to really compete with the Buddha as to be equal to the Buddha. One of the things that he tried to do eventually was to kill the Buddha so that he could take over as the leader of the Sangha. So I can't really answer the question, how could a person like Devadatta with a will to kill the Buddha attain jhana? I understand that his intention to kill the Buddha came after he had attained jhana. It was because he had attained jhana and had psychic powers that were of the mundane level, that is, that he wasn't an Aryan. He had attained jhana, but he, instead of using it to develop wisdom, insight, he used the powers to develop his ego, basically, so that his psychic powers were impressive to the people who were his followers, but they weren't based on attaining, using the jhanas to develop super mundane wisdom and become enlightened. So after he attained jhanas, it was only sometime later that he developed the idea to kill the Buddha to become leader of the Sangha. So it's a very good illustration of how when you develop a very powerful mind, you need to have that mind supported by precepts or ethical principles so that you use that powerful mind for good, not for harm, because it can lead to just a bigger ego. If you don't have the understanding of anatta, if you don't see that this isn't your personal property, this is something that has come about by cause and effect. And so this is why, as I said before, the whole of the Noble Eightfold Path has to be practiced in order to really develop spiritually and develop towards enlightenment. Dear Acharyayama, in Islam, Prophet Muhammad actually meditate in one cave for 1 week, if I'm not mistaken, before he spread the Al-Quran around the world. And one Muslim devotee told me that after Gautama Buddha, the Buddha's name, if translated into Arabic, is actually Prophet Muhammad. How true is this? Was Prophet Muhammad an enlightened being as well? Thanks. I have no idea. I really don't know. And I understand that people who live, say, in Malaysia or in other countries where they're constantly in contact with other religions, they may have questions like this that they really want an answer to, but I'm afraid that I cannot answer it for you. Though the joy of knowing the ordination was taking place was not available to me, I still rejoice in knowing that it did take place. It's incredible to be a functioning, complete Buddhist community. I never dreamed to see such a thing in this life. I support and love you, dear nuns, but I don't understand about the invitations being based on space restrictions. Past bhikkhu ordinations had no such concerns. Indeed, Kartina days, etc., draw huge, happy, slightly chaotic, but orderly crowds to Bodhnyana. It didn't seem to matter that not everyone fits into the hall. or when was just happy to be around with love and support all the same. So this is making a comment on our bhikkhuni ordination. Because we had to have two sanghas in the Sima at Bodhnyana, that is different from any other occasion which we've had previously. We had to have the Bhikkhu Sangha and the Bhikkhuni Sangha, because the ordination takes place first in the Bhikkhuni Sangha and then in the Bhikkhu Sangha. And we also had to be aware of the fact that not everyone was supporting us wholeheartedly. And so if anyone came into the Sima, into the consecrated ordination area, and expressed their disapproval of our ordination, that would be something that might be an obstacle to our going ahead. And so taking all things into account, we invited people to come because we had a very small window of opportunity when the bhikkhunis who were coming from overseas could be present altogether and the ceremony could be conducted. It was very important that we not miss that window of opportunity. So I'm sorry that not everyone that could be invited, or that it wasn't a public event, but the restriction on space is because we had to make sure that there was enough room for both sanghas and that everyone within the Sima was in agreement with what was happening. Dear Ajahn Vayama, a daily householder with a busy schedule, what would be the best routine for their meditation? Once a day, 1 hour, 10 minutes, but 3/4, 3 or 4 times a day? I'm sure Ajahn Vayama is going to talk about this, but I'll just mention that really you're the best person to know how to fit in your meditation according to your daily routine, and also whether it's going to flourish when you practice it. It's very good to sit every day, and if you can't sit for a long time, at least to have that sitting regularly. But if you don't sit for a longer time, you'll find that you spend the whole of the meditation period simply sorting through your daily activities, what's happened to you and what you've got to do tomorrow, and you'll have very little time to for the mind to become peaceful, and that to show you the benefits of the practice. You will get benefits even if you don't practice for long every day, but the opportunity to really experience peace and refreshment only comes once you get past that the part of the practice that is taken up with processing what has happened to you during the day. And it's when you really feel the peace that will give you the encouragement to continue your practice regularly. In a recent question about lay and sangha, Ajahn Brahm said jokingly, "They feed us and we are kind to them." Then he became serious and said, "No, that's not right. We are all in this together. What do you make of that?" I know some lay who have stronger, heavier practice than some ordained, but they don't ordain. And in suttas, enlightened lay people don't ordain even though they could. It's just part of it, all in it together. I don't really know what Achambam was meaning by that, but certainly we are all in this together because we all are human beings and we all share the human condition. So it's interesting, some people are not able to ordain because of family responsibilities. That is, they have people who depend on them. They're not able to take the ordination when they could. It's true that actually you have a lot more control over your life if you are a lay person than if you are monastic. In fact, we've talked about this quite a bit. Achambam is a very good example of a monastic who loves to be a monastic and who seems to find no boundaries in living out that monastic life. But there are other monastics who find it not so easy, not so supportive. There are many lay people who don't find their life supportive of their practice either, and they would love to be a monastic. So I think it's really the individual has to find what is suits them, and if they can ordain, then I would heartily recommend it. Because we've been lay people as well as monastics, we can talk from both sides. Sometimes as lay people, you can only talk from your experience, from your side, and it may not be representative. So I would say that the monastic life presents a lot of challenges, but it really is a wonderful way to be able to live if that's what's suitable for you. Most of the people in the suttas, if they became enlightened as lay people, then they had an option, had the option, as Achambam said the other day, of joining the Sangha or just dying as a lay person. And I don't know anyone who became a lay person who chose to die as a lay person, because as an enlightened being, there is no motivation to continue a lay life. There's long before one becomes an arahat, there is no more longer any sensual desire or ill will which drives us so much in daily life. So for an arahat to live a lay life, it's very, very difficult. There are some people who became enlightened on hearing words of the Buddha, but they either became a member of the Sangha or they died very, very quickly. So, for example, the example of Bahia, of the bark garment, who Achambam talked about the other night, when he went away to get his robes and bowl so that he could ordain, he was killed on the roadside by a cow. So we hear about those people who died very soon after their ordination, but we don't hear of people who decided, instead of becoming a monastic, to die as a lay person. So I'm not aware of any who decided to stay as a lay person and die, if anyone knows anyone. Dear Achan, independent origination, what is meant by formations and name and form? Much, much thanks. This requires a drink of water. I think really these questions are better directed to Achan Brahm, but I'll just briefly mention independent origination, which is traditionally considered as the Buddha's explanation of what keeps this life going from one life to the next. We start off with the life before this one, and then we move into this life, and then we move into the sequence that leads to rebirth into a life after this one. And basically, the formations give rise to consciousness. The formations are, in other words, known as the sankharas. And the sankharas are all of the mental machinations, the thinking, the planning, the willing, the ideas of moving to this and moving to that, unfinished business, which gives rise to consciousness. And all of us are here because when last life finished, we had unfinished business, basically the will to live, to continue to live, to be. And so that gives rise to consciousness, which in this life, that consciousness gives rise to the name and form, that is the materiality, that is the mental structure, that is the body, and the mentality, which is the mind, which goes along with that body, and which is dependent on sense contacts for feeding, as a way of feeding that mind. So when there was unfinished business of a particular kind in the last birth, gives rise to a particular kind of materiality, body, and mentality in this life, with the particular kinds of sense bases which feed the kind of mind and body. As human beings, we have particular kinds of senses that work in a particular way. If we were born as an animal, say a dog, we might have basically the same kind of senses, but they operate in the same way, but they function differently. So a dog's sense of smell is very acute, but his sense of sight is not as good as ours. So whatever the consciousness from the previous birth gives rise to, the name and the form, is the mind and the body. The body not just being the material form, but the sense bases. And then through those sense bases, we have all sorts of experiences which again interact with the mind and the body, so that there arises feelings of pleasure displeasure, not pleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant feelings. And in this life, that drives us on to liking and disliking, to acting, to making more mental formations, so that at the end of this life, we still have unfinished business. And so it gives rise to consciousness of a particular kind, which is reborn in a realm or a situation that's compatible, that gives rise again to name and form, to the mind and body that is appropriate for that consciousness. So basically that is what that is. I hope you could understand that. We must be getting near the end of the retreat. We're short on paper. Metta, how can one be more courageous and faithful in our own practice, and how to let this flow into dealing with all, even those we might not trust? How can we be more courageous and faithful in our own practice? I guess one way is because we see that this practice is bearing fruit in feeling more at peace within ourselves, feeling stronger, being more sure of what leads to happiness and what leads to suffering. So we develop a stronger personal inner confidence, which allows us to act in the world with more confidence and more acting as we speak, walking the talk, basically. And as we do that, we become stronger in ourselves, so that we can be hold our seat when we meet opposition or we meet a situation that causes us to waver. We are not so easily influenced as we used to be. This allows us to even be daring or courageous in our contacts with people. Instead of just going along with what everyone does, we are willing to stand our ground and be more sure of what that ground is. So really, it's by doing the practice we see the results in happiness, but also the practice itself bears fruit which we don't realise unless we really pay attention. So we may be firmer in our ideas of what's right and wrong and may be feeling more confident, but we haven't actually noticed that until we are challenged, and then afterwards we might think, gee, I didn't get so upset about that, or I wasn't so easily influenced this time. And up until then, we haven't really noticed that we've been growing in strength and inner confidence and self-respect within ourselves just as a result of doing the practice, not even deliberately trying to make these things happen. These things grow as qualities just as a result of doing the practice. So really that's what I can say, is you see the results, you see the benefits, and you deliberately keep cultivating this path so that it gives you more confidence to act out of really knowing that this is good for you. How to disagree in a community, how to come to consensus, how to still include everyone in community. This is a very hard question because whatever community we live in, we are also individuals and will have different ideas about things, different personality styles. So I think that it's very important to realise that and to acknowledge that and to allow that to be and not to let the outer appearances which seem to be apparent disagreement to be the whole of how we think about that person or what they have to say or that issue presented in a particular way. So it's really to look below the surface, and that's what our practice helps us to do. It helps us to look below our own surface or the surface of our own mind so that we are aware that sometimes how we present isn't actually getting the message across, that we can come back and be more truer to our own understandings or opinions or whatever, and we can recognise that that's the same for other people as well. And then how to come to consensus, even if you recognise that this takes work and you're willing to do the work, sometimes you can't come to consensus. And I think that's something that we need to recognise too, that it's not always possible to come to consensus. And then you have to decide whether it's all right to still include people in the community who don't agree. How do you work on those conditions where you don't have everyone in agreement but still included in the community? So our personal practice will help us very much to be able to, again, hold our seat, know where we're coming from, but also know that how we're presenting may not be really what we're meaning to say, and that as is true for us, is true for others. It's 9:15. Do people want to continue, or are you happy to continue? Yes. I think Ajahn Brahm said Buddha modelled Vinaya on the democratic system. He grew up in the Sakyans. The Sakyans were apparently a republic, and the king was elected. Is that right? Yes, it's right. I don't think it was, I may not be elected as we understand elections, but different, there was not just one family that was the ruling family. It was on the clan system. Have heard Ajahn Brahm allude to the fact that Western context helps to foster this democracy. Are you finding that Dhammasara runs more happily as a result of this aspect of the Buddha's legacy with love and respect? The question before was about how to disagree in a community, how to come to consensus, how to still include everyone in community. At Dhammasara Nuns Monastery, we're still working out how to do that. When the monastery started, and particularly when it was a 10-precept monastery, and we were starting to build up the monastery, basically, most of the decision making was made by me as the abbot. But particularly since we've in recent years tried to develop this sense of a Sangha working together, and particularly since we've become bhikkhunis, we try very much to work on the consensus basis, and that everyone, that is the bhikkhunis who are full-time resident at the monastery, all have a say in decision-making, and they have an equal say in what we decide. And we try to come to consensus on the decisions. But we're still working on it to make them completely harmonious, because there are differences in the way that we think things should be done, and how to be able to foster that sense of agreement and harmony, or harmony when even there is disagreement. That's something we're still working on, but it's certainly the ideal that we work within. Achin Vayama, how long did it take you to strive with your meditation to reach your first dhyana? Fortunately, I can say now that I'm a bhikkhuni, we're not allowed to discuss our meditation. Dear Achan, what advice would you personally give to someone starting on the road of meditation? Could you please share any tips or advice? With thanks, with metta. I think it's important to realise that there will be ups and downs, even if you start off in a meditation retreat and have a lot of peaceful experiences, or your clarity of mind develops, that it is difficult to maintain the same level out of retreat as in retreat. And people often get disappointed because they expect that for now there will be upwards and onwards. In fact, it's very often up and down, stop and start. And so I think it's really important to know that and not to be discouraged. Just to be prepared to start again, whether it's starting at home, starting fresh today, or starting again by going to a retreat again. And really, it's just the perseverance that's really important. Another thing that I found very useful is that when I was taught meditation, I was taught originally, encouraged to sit for an hour every day, or sit for an hour in the morning and an hour at night as a lay person. And I think that's often unrealistic. And people get discouraged because they think, if I don't do an hour, it's no good doing this, anything. So it's very useful, whatever time you can set aside for meditation, and particularly useful if you can keep it up every day. And it's also skillful to just find, whenever you've got some free time, to sit down and meditate. So you don't wait until you have an hour at a stretch to be free of distraction, but just according to your daily routine, those times of day when you can step aside from the normal activities and sit down and watch your breath. That will be very beneficial, because the more you do it, the more you will want to do it. And then just naturally, the time that you spend in meditation will grow and grow and grow. Dear Achan, could you please say something about the restraint of the senses, awareness of the beauties of nature, of the music of Bach and Mozart, or of mathematics, all depend on sight, sound, and the mind. Is developing these detrimental to developing the inner senseless faculty? I think that those in their place can be useful, and all of these things require that you have some focus and awareness of what you are doing or seeing or whatever or listening to, and so they can be useful, because they are training the mind to stay with one thing to the exclusion of others, and they also bring the mind happiness or peacefulness or joyfulness, which is very important for developing the mind further in meditation. So they can be very useful, but as you've probably experienced on this retreat, it's very nice not to have to talk, not to have to look, not to have to listen, not to have to engage with the senses. And the Buddha is pointing to the fact that when the mind is really peaceful and able to experience, it will experience even the nicest sense contact as suffering. And he gave a very powerful simile, which I always remembered from my first meditation retreat, and that was that sense contacts are akin to flies landing on the bare flesh of a cow that's been skinned alive. That is a very powerful simile, and it's to illustrate that sense contacts, even the most pleasant contacts, are actually suffering. And this you can experience directly as the mind develops in meditation. But as I said, these sense contacts can be useful, because they are a way of preparing the mind or training the mind out of meditation to focus, and also they bring happiness into the mind. But when one is meditating and one wants to cultivate this path, one soon realizes that the quality of sense contacts, the intensity of sense contacts, the kind of sense contacts will all have an effect on the mind. When you try to sit down and meditate, you'll realize something that you saw or looked at or read or heard or whatever often leaves what Ajahn Brahm calls an echo in the mind, and it's very difficult to clear the mind, and so you become more aware of the impact that sense contacts have on the mind and more careful about what you expose the mind to. Dear Ajahn, could you explain the meaning of not busy with duties in the metta chanting? Thank you. So this is also a question which is asked because we used to have not burden with duties, which gives the connotation that you can be busy as long as you're not burdened by the busyness. But actually, one of the qualities that helps in your meditation practice is not to be too busy with duties, not to have too many things on your plate or on your mind at the one time. It basically means trying to simplify your life, trying to take out the things that are unnecessary, take out the non-essential things. And you will find naturally that happens the more that you turn towards meditation, and the more pleasure that you get from meditation itself, the more that you look, the less that you'll need to look for pleasure in activities or in other things. There are some duties which you cannot avoid fulfilling. So you fulfill them to the best of your ability, but you try to naturally cut down on those things which you don't really need to be involved in. Ajahn, why is it not possible to become enlightened without hearing Dhamma? If cessation, extinguishing of the flame will naturally happen anyway, that seems to suggest hearing Dhamma is not essential. The Buddha gave as a causative or necessary factor the hearing the words of another, hearing the Dhamma. But of course, there are Pacheka Buddhas who become enlightened without hearing the teaching from anyone else. So obviously it is possible to become enlightened without hearing the Dhamma from someone else. But for most people, and for those of us without great paramis, to become Pacheka Buddhas, then it's useful to hear the Dhamma from someone else. And for that, we can reflect how great is our good karma that we have the opportunity to hear the Dhamma from someone else, that we've come in contact with the Dhamma in this life. So rather than looking on as we are not fortunate, we can also look on it the other way. We are very fortunate that we come in contact with the Dhamma. The flame also that's alluded to here, if cessation, extinguishing of the flame will happen naturally anyway, the flame is only extinguished when the necessary conditions to keep the flame alive are removed. That it doesn't happen naturally in the sense that it happens without causes and conditions. So that's why hearing the Dhamma is one of the causes for becoming enlightened. Ajahn, is it possible for a Mahayana monk or nun to become enlightened, or any tradition other than Theravada? Thank you. The Buddha said that it's possible for any person to become enlightened who is practicing the Noble Eightfold Path. Within any religion, if the Noble Eightfold Path is practiced, then that is the necessary condition for enlightenment. So you don't have to call yourself a Buddhist. You don't have to belong to a particular tradition. It depends on what kind of practice you're doing. And if the Noble Eightfold Path is part of that practice, then you have the ingredients for practicing for enlightenment. Can you please say something about what full ordination of nuns means for the Dharma? So, as I said earlier, the important thing from our point of view is that it means that we are full members of the Sangha, and female monastics have been examples of living the Dharma, of sharing the Dharma, teaching the Dharma without higher ordination. But higher ordination means that we have full access to the facilities and resources and support that is available for monks as anyway. Things like the places to study, the opportunities to be in a situation where there will be teaching and teachers and all that sort of thing. So it means that the female practitioners now have equal access to those resources, and they can share those resources, their understanding, their insights with the lay community that supports them on an even greater level. So in terms of making that the opportunities available, that is really a very great resource for us all, and that makes the Dharma more available, available in more situations and to a greater extent because of the full ordination of nuns. Keep getting these very long questions. Dear Ajahn, where did the four qualities of our heart come from? Loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Do they need to be deliberately cultivated through practices such as metta meditation? Or are they the kind of a manifested form of nibbana in human sensory recognizable way? I would like to know if these are the natural outcoming of attaining the nibbana, or you need to cultivate them through efforts. The not being enlightened, I'm only speaking in theory, but as you've experienced in this retreat, the more peaceful and more quiet the mind is, the more still the mind becomes, the more joy arises from within. These qualities are inherent in the mind and are obstructed by defilements. So the natural state of the mind is happiness, joyfulness, peacefulness, all of the things that go along with loving kindness, compassion, sympathy, joy, and equanimity. Because you're not, your orientation to the world is not a self-centered point of view any longer. You've experienced that even so briefly in the meditation, whenever there is an absence of concern with this body or concern with your environment, when the mind is able to experience itself, it experiences great the happiness and joy, and also because there's a lack of self-centeredness at that time, also there's a feeling of affinity with other beings. We cultivate these things while we are still developing this path. That's why it's very useful to do loving-kindness meditation. to happiness in the joy of others, that's to cultivate those qualities, to know that these are things which feel good, things that we shouldn't be afraid of in the enlightened mind, because there is an absence of self-centeredness, an absence of greed, hatred and delusion. These qualities arise naturally and spontaneously. Dear Achan Bayama, I understand that due to current circumstances, you do not make public Dharma talks. However, do you still provide formal teachings to your student bhikkhunis? If so, is there any chance that recordings of such talks be made available via the web? Your teachings have been very simple and lucid, and not many teachers are able to deliver such clear Dharma teachings. Well, I'm not able to deliver clear at the moment. We simply missed the chance to listen to your talks and hence the request. That's very nice. Thank you very much for whoever wrote that. At the moment, I'm not teaching. Achan Brahm sprung this on me to do this tonight. I didn't expect that I would be teaching. So no, I'm not teaching at the moment. But thank you for the request. After such a long time as a nun, why bother becoming a bhikkhuni? How has your lifestyle changed since the ordination? Well, I think I've said that the main reason for becoming a bhikkhuni was to become a full member of the Sangha. And how has your lifestyle changed since the ordination? Because Dharmasara was set up the way that it was from the beginning, it's really been a seamless transformation from 10 precept nun to bhikkhuni. Now, many of the things that we used to do have a formal structure. So, for example, we used to meet every fortnight and we would talk about the training and confess any wrongdoings and talk about how we could do better in the training or changes that could take place. Now we as bhikkhunis, we have a more formally clearly set out set of rules beyond the 10 precepts. But as 10 precept nuns, we were following largely the bhikkhuni rules anyway, but we weren't having to formally confess them or formally hold them in the way that we do now as bhikkhunis. So many of the procedures that we would do, we now have a more formal structure for doing them as bhikkhunis. As far as receiving the requisites, dealing with the requisites, we always dealt with them and received the requisites, particularly the food every day, in the manner of bhikkhunis. So there has been very little change that needed to take place at Dharmasara since the bhikkhuni ordination. How has the increased zeal of practicing 311 rules helped your practice and happiness? Are there any of the nuns' rules you have found particularly helpful? I think I'll give that to Venerable Sari to answer. Thank you. Before the last question.
Has the increased zeal of practice 311 rules help your practice and happiness? Then as Ajahn Varma say, now we actually formalize our sort of like something like confession, and every 2 weeks that we have that formal procedures to do. So something simple that we might don't forget about, but now I'm consciously aware actually didn't do that. So I need to make it known or confess during the confession time, which helped me even sometimes very small things, like we have something like, you know, bringing bath robes into our showers, small things, but because I'm not mindful, I've forgotten. Or something like medicines, like 7 days, I only can keep certain things, the sweets, that for 7 days, but I left one in my pocket that I've forgotten because of not being mindful. Then I go to make a confession and relinquish that sweet. So even though things are something small, but it help with the mindfulness practice. Like I can't just say, oh, don't worry about it. So very small things sort of remind myself or bring back to, hang on a minute, I haven't been. It set out a boundaries for me that I can't sort of like more aware of what is going on in my mind. What I've been doing, I've forgotten about something, or didn't do something correctly, or that's helped. And happiness, I must say, you know, for me, that last Ajahn must say, every 2 weeks now, we need to recite the Padimokkha. To tell the truth, I felt a tremendous amount of happiness when I sat through the recitation of the Padimokkha. The fact that I said, wow, I can't, that's, it's difficult to explain. It's a feeling of, you know, wow, that's all of us sitting there, that all the rules being recited and we're pure. It takes 2 hours. We're getting better. We're actually thinking less. It took 2 hours to recite the Padimokkha. Everyone got to sit there in the same position. You can't get up and go somewhere else. You can have a drink of water. But for me, I felt tremendously I felt happy. Actually, I'm not the only one who said that. I had bhikkhunis. Oh, I'm learning to reciting the Padimokkha as well, and also learning to memorizing it as well at the moment. So it brings greater happiness to be able to do that. And that's one of the happiness that I felt in my heart, that I can't sort of like point out exactly where is it, but one of the bhikkhunis who recited together last year too, she said, you know, at the end, when we say, this is the end of the bhikkhuni Padimokkha, she said she, each time at the end of it, she felt happiness, that, wow, that guy, pure in keeping the precepts. So of that, that's something that I felt very happy and bring lots of peace and free of remorse in my life that I'm very happy about. Are there any of the nuns' rules you have found particularly helpful? I can't think of. It's 9:30, so I can't think of something that comes to the mind immediately. Well, just now someone asked whether Ajahn, when is the first time that Ajahn Vajra chanted the first jhana? It's not just particularly the nuns' rule. Actually, it's also the bhikkhus' rules as well. It's helpful to, you know, to not need to talk about something like that. It's protective of the whole sangha, that so that people will not be just, so, oh, okay, Sister Jackie attained jhanas. We only offer things to her, and not offering to Venerable Seri or something. So that is become fit, sort of encourage that is fairness and harmony. So we will not feel, oh, that one always gets. So that's a wonderful way. So that's one of the rules that just come to my mind that I find is beneficial. There's many other rules, but I can't think of it at close to 10 o'clock at night. Thank you.
Just before I give the last question, actually this brings up one of the very important reasons for having bhikkhuni ordination. Because the there was a rule that the Sangha cannot talk about their attainments and discuss meditation with lay people, because the Buddha didn't want the Sangha trying to influence the lay people to get their support. Because the nuns were not a member of the Sangha, fully officially recognized, it meant that we could not take part fully in discussions about our meditation practice and hear from monks who had what were their experiences in meditation, because we weren't considered to be members of the Sangha either. So now that we are bhikkhunis, there is much more likelihood that we will be able to fully engage with monks as well as nuns on the subjects of meditation. And of course, you can imagine that this will be extremely helpful to us and extremely helpful to those people that we are going to be teaching, whether lay or monastic. So that's one of the really important reasons for becoming bhikkhunis. Do you believe we here on the retreat can all reach enlightenment in this lifetime, even though some of us are entering our elder years? Can you please talk and inspire on the sense of urgency in this regard? Much metta and love. It's very nice. The potential is there for all of us to reach enlightenment, but who can say when? I think, actually, we were just talking about this recently. One of the things which I was exposed to in Sri Lanka in my early years was a belief that people couldn't attain enlightenment these days. And so there became very much a reaction to that of wishing that we could attain enlightenment in this life, or acknowledging openly that it was possible still to become enlightened. And that in some obviously is very good to make that people aware that it's still a possibility, but it also can in some situations place a lot of stress on the fact that you should be able to attain enlightenment in this life. And so I think it can be beneficial if we know that enlightenment is possible and we all have the potential to attain enlightenment, and it is possible in this lifetime if we do the work, but each of us has our own karmic conditions to work with, and that may not mean enlightenment in this life for us. Not that the karma means that we can't, it's just that we have to work on more things in order to get to the point of enlightenment. So the enlightenment in this lifetime can be a stressor, because we think we should attain enlightenment. That enlightenment is possible is much more helpful. But the person mentioned a sense of urgency, and this the Buddha really encouraged us to recognize, that we are destined to die, and if we aren't enlightened, to be reborn somewhere. So it's good if we can think that we're practicing well. If we become enlightened, that'll be wonderful, but at least we're setting up good conditions which are supporting us for this life and for the next life as well. And I think that is a much more useful way to think of it, but not to think that we should actively delay our enlightenment, but just be open to the prospect that it may not happen in this lifetime. We still have work to do nonetheless. So that's the last question.